Dan Rather is the best at digging up unbelievable stories. But if you're looking for some surprises, check out Music's Greatest Mysteries, the podcast. Hey there. Welcome to Dan Rather's The Big Interview, the podcast for music lovers, full of thought-provoking interviews and conversations like you've never heard before with some of the biggest names in the biz. Each episode will bring you exclusive, in-depth interviews from your favorite artists, from classic rock and country to timeless music everyone enjoys. We cover it all right here on Dan Rather's The Big Interview. So sit back and enjoy these magnificent stories from the artists that lived it. Here's your host, Dan Rather. Sugar Magnolia,
blossoms blooming, that's all. Tonight, on The Big Interview, he's a founding member of the Grateful Dead and a founding father of rock and roll, Bob Weir.
What we provide for people is music with a little adventure in it. And the people who like our music, who come to our music, or drawn to our music, are people who require a little adventure in their lives and therefore in their music.
It all began when he walked into a guitar shop where a young man named Jerry Garcia was playing the banjo. Did he doubt or did he try? Since then, he spent more than 50 years on stages around the world. One man gathers what another
man spills. If we think about it and say, wow, we started, we had no idea how this was going to turn out.
Every now and again, I get a bit dizzied by what's transpired. I was asking for it. I sure as hell got it. Well, I rocked and I
rapped and I rambled. Still writing, still composing, a true American music legend. The Grateful Dead's Bob Weir, tonight on The Big Interview. Chugging like the doodah man once told me
you got to pay your hand sometimes. What is this?
Well, this is, I think, is an example of what they call a sort of neo-North Korean impressionist socialist realism or something like that.
When you walk into Bob Weir's recording studio in Northern California, you are greeted by a giant mural of Bob Weir. But this is not your everyday portrait. This is a key card collage made up of room keys from hotels the band has stayed in around the world. It took thousands of keys to create, which is perhaps symbolic of Weir and his bandmates' success. The Grateful Dead has traveled the world many times over and in the process gained millions of loyal followers, in no small part because they deliver one of the greatest live shows in the history of rock and roll. And it all began more than 50 years ago when Bob Weir met Jerry Garcia in a Palo Alto, California guitar shop. Weir was 16 at the time. He and Jerry started a jug band. Their beginning coincided with the 60s counterculture movement that began in the Bay Area, a movement of young people resisting the conformity of the 50s. See that girl barefoot in the floor. Born in the crucible of acid trips and psychedelic sounds, the Grateful Dead wanted to explore music in their own way. Your demo then exploded at the bus stop in his place. Apart from the prevailing sounds of record labels and radio. If my words did glow with the cold. It's hard to believe Jerry Garcia has been gone for 20 years. But the Grateful Dead endures. Far from countercultural, the band has become an iconic piece of Americana, celebrating folk, bluegrass, blues, jazz, and straight-out rock and roll. What started in Haight-Ashbury still resonates with new generations, 50 years on. The band is considered a living showcase of American sounds and traditions, and its backbone is Bob Weir. This summer, the band said goodbye to its fans with what was labeled as the Fare Thee Well Concerts. We sat down with Weir in his recording studio just before those final performances. Well, Bob, thank you again for doing this. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Let's talk some business first. What about the Fare Thee Well tour? Tell me about it and how you feel about it.
You know, it's the right thing to do. I guess it'll bring a little closure for our fans who were, you know, graciously and generously supported us through the years. And also it's a chance for us to continue a conversation that we've been having for 50 years now. And it's a pithy one. There's a lot going on in that conversation. There are a lot of topics that that we're not done with, I don't think. And over the years, as we learn and grow and all that kind of stuff, we, just as we always did, we bring stuff back to the fold and mix and mash and stir and see what comes of it.
Well, let me back up just a little, because many people in the audience, I would think most of them at least heard the Grateful Dead, but not everybody knows who and what the Grateful Dead has been, is, and what you hope it to be. So let's go back. As it started, who and what was the Grateful Dead?
That's a big question. It started for me on a New Year's Eve in between 1963 and 64. I was wandering the back streets of Palo Alto with a couple of friends, and we heard banjo music coming out from behind the music store that we used to frequent. We were folkies at the time. I had just turned 16, and we just knocked on the door, and Jerry came in. We knew it was Jerry. Everybody knew that he was the banjo teacher there.
Jerry Garcia.
Yeah, Jerry Garcia, and guitar teacher as well. And we just sort of invited ourselves in. He asked us if we played instruments, and we, sure. Well, I got the keys to the front. Let's go break out some instruments and kick some stuff around. And we did, and we had that evening so much fun that we decided we couldn't just walk away from it. Might as well just make a little band out of it, which we did. It was a jug band. Jug band music was popular back then. This is what Jerry used to call the folk scare days. And jug band music was, it happened on all the riverboat stops from New Orleans up to, say, Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And Memphis, St. Louis, all along the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. And the jug band musicians were the same musicians that were the minstrel musicians on the riverboats. And it was the same music and stuff like that. But when they were on dry land, it was a little more, you know, they played in the dark towns on the street corners. And it was a little more bluesy. A little less showmanship, a little less shtick, if you will.
But you know about an old-fashioned jug band now, one that, say, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn would have recognized in their time.
Yeah, that's the music we were playing. And that music went on to become what we call funk music now. Mm-hmm. Funk music comes from all the same places, all the same cities. Big hotbed of funk music in Cincinnati, for instance. But you get it in New Orleans, you get it in Memphis, you get it in St. Louis. And it's the same scales, same rhythms, basically. The biggest difference is electric instruments and the hi-hat cymbal.
So you start like this jug band with Jerry Garcia after the fortuitous New Year's Eve meeting. What was that band called originally?
It was called, the band was called Mother McCree's Uptown Jug Champions. It took us a little while to paste all that together. And we did well. We did well for a year or so. At the age of 16, I was making pretty good money for a 16-year-old. There was a little tension at home because I maybe have been somewhat neglecting my studies and stuff like that. And I grew up under the shadow of Hoover Tower. My folks had Stanford in mind for me, not an itinerant troubadour. But my folks could clearly see that I was really following my bliss. Yeah. And they were, you know, I was sort of headstrong, and so, you know, experience had taught them that they would want to be delicate about trying to shift my course. And they never really did manage to shift my course. You know, I was off into music. So anyway, the drug band did well for about a year. And toward the end of that year, the Beatles had been, they came out right about the time, they hit the airwaves in America right about the time that we were being successful as a drug band. And by the end of that year, I was working in the music store. I had taken Jerry's beginning and intermediate students, and was teaching guitar and banjo in there. But the electric instruments were starting to give us the old come hither, and it just looked like too much fun to ignore.
And you were looking at the Beatles and listening and saying, "We can do that."
Yeah, we were thinking these guys are awful good, but they also look like they're having an awful lot of fun. You know, we can get good, and we know how to have fun. So let's go for it. And we did.
And that's when the Grateful Dead were born.
Yeah.
So that's what the Grateful Dead was in the beginning. And what did the Grateful Dead become?
We were eclectic. We were real serious about music. Real engaged in music. Any music that we could find that we could understand and find intriguing. But it was, you know, the focus was music, not fashion, for instance, because in popular music, there's an overlay of music as fashion. And we more or less rejected that. You know, for instance, we were one of the first outfits that went sort of towards our country roots, because Jerry and I had grown up listening to country music on the radio. It was part of the, you know, if you didn't like what was on the radio, you'd push a button, and there were all kinds of stations in the Bay Area, particularly. We had R&B stations, we had classical stations, we had jazz stations, and we'd listen to all of it. And so country music was part of part of that swamp that we grew out of. It was just too much fun to sing those songs and too fulfilling to sing those songs. And so we figured, okay, well, we'll just have to work these up and present them with some amount of authority so that the rock audiences of that day would find it palatable and let us get away with it.
Well, they certainly found it palatable and let you get away with it, to say the least. So the Grateful Dead becomes a very popular band, concert band, but you weren't concentrating on recording. I mean, you didn't hear the Grateful Dead all that much on radio.
We were real good at relating to a live audience, and that wasn't there in the studio. And it was hard for us to find a point of focus in the studio, playing for a machine, playing for a board like this. We never got all that good at it. We made a couple of pretty good records, or a few good records, actually. But what we did was, you know, what we were good at was stating a theme, then taking it for a little walk in the woods.
Before a live audience.
For a live audience.
Right.
That we could, you know, that we could bring along, because their energy, their appreciation, which you can feel on the moment, it energized us, it energized the music.
You're listening to Dan Rather's The Big Interview. We'll be back with Bob Weir. Welcome back to Dan Rather's The Big Interview. Today's guest is Bob Weir.
California, a prophet on the burning shore.
From their headquarters at 710 Ashbury Street, the Grateful Dead was at the center of the LSD-dropping, hippie counterculture of San Francisco in the mid-60s. Before becoming an epic touring band in the 1970s and 1980s, the ethos was always the same, not to make money, but to give their fans a memorable experience.
How big a factor, if it was a factor, was LSD in the popularity of the band?
The connection between the Grateful Dead and LSD in particular, and drugs in general, was more a connection, I think, with our association with the spirit of adventure. I quit taking LSD after about a year after I started taking it because I had pretty much seen, I thought, at that time, at the tender age of, I think, this time 18, that I'd seen pretty much what it had to offer. LSD was a way of stepping into an adventure, but we were finding other ways of stepping into that adventure, and music has plenty of avenues for adventure if you're willing to go there.
Did you ever think that those children from the 60s, 70s would follow you all over the country and keep the Grateful Dead popular here in, as we said, in 2015?
We never thought much about the future. We were pretty well invested into the present. We were finding fulfillment there. I think we always more or less assumed that without making plans and elaborate constructs of our lives, that we would amount to something. And I think we always assumed that our fans would as well, that as we evolved, so would they. They would demand more of us in terms of expertise, in terms of outlook, in terms of all that. And we were more than happy to provide that for them because we require that of ourselves.
Now, you're still a relatively young man, certainly from where I sit. Right. But do you think at all about the impact on society that the group has had?
Ask me in 100 years. Once again, I'm still invested in the moment because that's the only place that I can find fulfillment, fruition. You know, I came in here the night my dad died and put down some songs. That's what I do. That's where I live. And then there are people who are still reacting to what happened back in the 60s and trying to put that all back to bed and bring our culture back to something that they imagine it was like before that explosion of consciousness that happened in the 60s. Tuck that all back in, try to put that all back in the box, and I've got sad news for those folks that, you know, that horse is out of the barn.
I'm going to hold to that point for a moment, what you call the explosion of consciousness during the 60s, and born partly of idealism. Is this what has been the major attraction of the Grateful Dead over these years and what keeps it still a social phenomenon?
That would be my guess. I've often said that that what we provide for people is music with a little adventure in it. And the people who like our music, who come to our music, or drawn to our music, are people who require a little adventure in their lives and therefore in their music. And that adventure, when you're in a world full of adventure, you need to be fast on your feet. You need to be light on your feet and able to, you have to be eclectic in your tastes and in the places you draw your information from that informs your decisions. You can't be rigid. And this kind of worldview is kind of what our music expresses. You know, on stage, things are happening thick and fast. And it's a matter of stepping back from what I'm doing for me and listening to everything else that's happening on the stage and then relating to that.
Well, sun went down in honey.
More of my interview with Bob Weir is straight ahead, so stay here with us.
You're listening to Dan Rather's The Big Interview. We'll be back with Bob Weir. Welcome back to Dan Rather's The Big Interview. Today's guest is Bob Weir.
Bob Weir was adopted and raised in Atherton, California, south of San Francisco. He grew up in a wealthy, conservative family. He said it was a loving family that had higher expectations for their son than life in a jug band.
When I was 15, I thought it would be a terribly romantic thing to do, to run away and be a cowboy. I shoveled a lot of stalls. And spent some time in the bunkhouse. I was the kid with the guitar. And in the bunkhouse, these guys had grown up in a culture where there wasn't radio back in their day, not to mention TV. So what you did at night was you uncorked a bottle of whiskey, and you told stories, and you sang cowboy songs. And I'd have the guy, you know, the guys would, No, that's not right. Yeah, that's it. That's how it goes. And they teach me these cowboy songs that they would sing.
You remember any of those cowboy songs?
A few of them, yeah.
Like Strawberry Roan, that sort of thing?
Strawberry Roan, Blue Mountain was. I'm actually doing a record now that's what we're calling the Cowboy Project, but really it's not cowboy songs, but it's stuff that's we're trying to evolve out of that tradition.
And but you were saying at 15 that you were sitting around the bunkhouse at night dreaming of being a cowboy. I'm reminded of Willie Nelson's song, Mothers Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys.
Right.
And I gather your parents weren't all that approving of it.
Well, I was in a good place, and it was a summer job, and they figured it'd teach me put a little structure in my life, which it did. You know, I was up, you know, before daybreak and doing all the stuff that a ranch hand does.
Yeah. I want to come back to, we were talking about the impact on society. I mean, you grew from that summer of dreaming of being a cowboy and getting a little structure in your life, but then you took up with first the jug band, then the Grateful Dead, didn't finish high school, didn't go to college. You'd found your bliss.
Yeah, well, I'm dyslexic in the extreme, so an academic career was probably not in the cards for me. I tested out with high IQ and all that kind of stuff when I was a kid, but I was thought to be an underachiever because for some reason it wasn't translating to my grades. I finally got my grades up by learning how to just basically bullshit my instructors. Pay attention enough to be able to know what they wanted to hear and let them hear that.
But you were an adopted child.
Yeah.
And your adopted parents were people of means.
Mm-hmm.
And they had high hopes for you academically.
Yeah.
You said they aspired for you to go to Stanford.
Yeah.
Wasn't on.
You know, and I aspired to go to Stanford, but it was a goal too far. It was out of reach. Maybe I might have managed to get into a good school if I'd stuck with it, but music was all I could think about.
So once your family decided, listen, he certainly isn't going to Stanford, he's into music, they in effect kicked you out of the house?
No, I just left. The bus was leaving, and I sort of slipped off. I'm not sure that I said a proper goodbye. I'd come back around. I loved my parents dearly, and I didn't feel real good about not living up to their expectations. But I was doing what I felt called to do, I guess.
Bob Weir's adoptive parents died in 1971, and a decade later, out of nowhere, Weir got an astonishing phone call.
The telephone rings. It's the morning. It's my office. They're saying there's a lady on the line who says she's her name is Phyllis, and she says she's your mother. And she also used the last name that was on my birth certificate, and no one would know that but me. And so I said, well, put her through. And so we met, and I had 12 other siblings. She had been prolific. And so, you know, I would call her every now and again. She'd been following me throughout my career because she knew who I was and what I was up to.
But excuse me, the 12 siblings, were any of those put up for adoption?
No, just me.
And when she had the children later, she kept the children
yeah.
and stayed their mother. What an amazing thing.
Yeah.
So you eventually met her and talked to her.
Yeah. And she gave me some information regarding my dad, and then I chased that down with a private investigator. It took about 20 minutes to find out that he was, at this point, the commanding officer here at the local Air Force base. Uh-huh. And so I just sort of put that information in my back pocket for about 10 years, and finally worked up the nerve to call him.
Took you 10 years to
yeah.
decide to call him.
Yeah. We met the next day for lunch.
Was he surprised or astounded?
He was astounded. He had no idea I existed. My natural dad and my natural mom had a good old-fashioned fling back at the University of Arizona, but when she realized she was pregnant, she slipped off to San Francisco, where I was born, mm-hmm. quietly. And when she came back to Arizona, she made no mention of me. The conversation went kind of like this. I make the phone call. he answers. I said, I figured I had about a 20-second window before it was thanks, I already have one, click. And I told him, well, hi, my name is Robert Weir. I live in Mill Valley, and I've been doing some research and turned up some information that might be of considerable interest to you. He says, okay, well, I'm on the line with on another line right now. Can you call me back in 10 minutes? And so that was a long 10 minutes, and I called him back with the same.
Did you think that he would answer the call, or you think he wouldn't ever take a call again?
I didn't know.
Right.
Called him again, same name is Robert Weir. I have to ask you a question or two regarding certain events that transpired in Tucson 50 years ago. And he gets real quiet. And I said, well, sir, did you know and were you perhaps romantically involved with a young lady by the name of Phyllis at that time? And he said, well, yes. And I said, well, sir, I don't know how many kids you have, but there's a strong likelihood that you have one more than you know. Long pause. And he says, well, the only Robert Weir that I know of is this guy who sings and plays for the Grateful Dead. And I said, well, sir, that would be me. Another long pause. And then he told me, well, listen, it's not every day you get a call like this. Can I call you back in 20 minutes? And he did. And we arranged to meet the next day for lunch. And at lunch, at first, there was a lot of...
Really looking you over and you looking him over.
Yeah, both. You know, both of us very acutely interested in what this other guy's all about. And after about 20 minutes, we became very, very close friends and stayed that way. And he was my dad.
I find that an amazing story.
Yeah. Straight up Reader's Digest kind of stuff.
The Grateful Dead constantly invested in technology to improve the live experience for deadheads. The Wall of Sound, built in 1974, was the largest sound system of its day, blasting music, distortion-free, they said, to listeners a half mile away.
This is our A studio room. We were in the A control room, and this is the...
Today, Weir continues to push the envelope. In his studio, which he calls the ultimate playpen for musicians, he has installed an acoustic system that can mimic any environment he wants, all with a simple swipe on his iPad.
This one here is a cathedral.
Well, let me get this. I'm amazed. All these speakers, all these microphones, and you can create, recreate, if you will, in sound in this studio, say, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
What is the Mormon?
They sing?
The Mormon Tabernacle, if they'll let us in there.
Oh, Radio City Music Hall?
Yeah.
In other words, you can create the same ambience in this room.
Yeah.
Cutting-edge stuff, it strikes me.
Yeah, I was pushing it forward, trying to keep the ball going down the field.
We used to play for silver, now we play for life.
Weir's hosted plenty of rehearsals here, including this one with his band, Further.
You know, in this room, virtually every musician who walks in here and starts playing, universal reaction is their jaw drops.
Strikes me as it's the musical, technical equivalent of maybe an F-22. Part of the Grateful Dead's success is you've always concentrated on the live audience, worked on everything from the sound to the lights. Everything is concentrated in the concert, not on the making of records.
When we got into the studio, we concentrated there, but we didn't spend that much time in the studio. So, you know, we had an enormous organization that we had, you know, it was a big bulldog to feed. And so we had to stay on the road a lot to do that. And so we spent a lot of time on the road. And in order to make it make sense for us, to feel fulfilling, we had to make it better every time we went out, whether it meant dressing up our stage with art or keeping abreast of the latest offerings of audio sound reinforcement.
All that high tech doesn't come cheaply, which seems ironic because the Grateful Dead business model looks like a recipe to lose money. It was not something the music industry had ever experienced before. The band allowed those attending their concerts to tape them for free.
What about tickets? I'm curious particularly about what's called the taper tickets. First of all, what is a taper ticket and why do you do it?
Well, way back in the 70s when people started recording our shows, first off, our record company said, you got to shut this down. And we looked at the situation and said, you want it shut down, you come in and shut it down. We don't want to be cops. And they looked at the situation and said, well, we don't want to shut it down either. You know, how that worked out is that, you know, the tapes went out and they just promoted what we did. But there were a lot of people who resented having to peer around microphone stands to see the band. So we figured, okay, let's put all the tapers in one section.
I don't know of any band that allows people to come in mass, as it were, as a whole section to tape the performance. That's considered bad business.
Well, you know, people tried to persuade us of that, but it never worked out to be bad business for us. Yeah, maybe we didn't sell as many records as we might have, but we didn't make great records. We were real good at playing live, and that's what people wanted. And the tapes of those, you know, people would pass them to their friends, to their siblings and stuff like that, and we'd get new fans.
When you pull back for what we in television call the wide shot, mm-hmm. to look at the Grateful Dead, whether you like the Grateful Dead or not, whether you know very much about them or not, they've really been intertwined in American history for about a half a century.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the fabric of the country, part of Americana, mm-hmm. if you will. At night when you're, just before you go to sleep, or maybe you're taking a walk around in the daytime, do you ever think about it and say, wow, when we started, we had no idea where we're, how this is going to turn out.
Every now and again, I get a bit dizzied by what's transpired. I was asking for it. I sure as hell got it. I knocked on the door and it opened wide, and some sort of wind caught me from behind and swept me through that door, and the ground fell away, and I was transported elsewhere, and have lived my life there.
Jerry Garcia was, by acclamation, the leader of the Grateful Dead, and when he died, there were many people, myself included, who thought, well, that'll be the end of the Grateful Dead. It may be, they may be a little slow going, but that'll be the end of it. When Jerry passed, did that thought cross your mind?
No. First off, the Grateful Dead was a fair bit more democratic than people really seemed to understand. It's okay. Whatever you want to think, go ahead and think it. And what it was that we were up to was more democratic than people seem to understand.
And Jerry Garcia, was he a father figure, big brother figure combined? Where did he fit in?
More or less a big brother figure. We were brothers for sure, or as I've often said, what we had and what we had in the band together was, you know, they say that blood is thicker than water, and really what we had was way thicker than blood.
My inspiration flow in token rhyme, suggesting rhythm.
The Grateful Dead has had few commercial radio hits or chart-topping records. Some songs, like Terrapin Station, run 16 minutes long and are hardly radio-friendly. But the Dead always drew a crowd like no other band.
Well, I rapped and I rapped and I rambled.
Now, straight ahead, a little music from the master. The Big Interview with Bob Weir rolls on in a moment.
I'll do this tune that I'm working on. It's an old cowboy tune that I've wanted to pull together for, I first learned it in a bunkhouse, I think, or first heard it, and I wanted to pull it together for 50-some years, and finally in doing that, in order to do that, I had to write some of the verses that I didn't remember. I had to just go back. I guess it's the folk process. I was born in manger in Texas. The doggies and paints come round. My days there were troubled and restless. All the trouble I looked for I found. My welcome wore thin down in Texas for reasons you won't want to know. Well, I rapped and I rapped and I rambled to where the sage and the pinion do grow. Blue Mountain, Blue Mountain, your sides are steep. Blue Mountain, with a horse head on your side, you stole my love to keep. You stole my love to keep.
Oh, love it. What's the name of this tune?
That's called Blue Mountain.
And this is on a new album?
Hey, it's gonna be.
Gonna be.
This is sort of the bedrock. I'm going to write probably a dozen more verses for it.
Well, fair to say that you're most famous for composing the music. Mm-hmm. Do the lyrics come harder for you?
Oh, yeah, much. Mm-hmm. I write decent lyrics, but I'm slow as a slug in a trance.
Well, this is terrific. And what about the guitar?
This guitar is an old one. I found it on Craigslist about 10 years ago. It was unplayable. I got it for almost nothing. But I knew that I wanted a guitar, an old Martin guitar of this model. So I sent it back to the Martin factory to have them reset the neck so it, you know, it was, you know, the strings were about this high off the frets. They reset the neck and they said, oh, by the way, this guitar is something of a museum piece. It was made in 1939.
That's the reason I ask about it. It looks like it might be.
And you can't get them anymore, and they just don't make them like this anymore.
Did you have any formal training in guitar, or you just picked it up?
No, I just picked it up. I had one lesson early on, and they tried to teach me, the teacher tried to teach me to, you know, by learning to read music. And that wasn't, you know, I'm dyslexic. That just is not going to happen for a dyslexic fellow like me.
I hadn't thought about that. So you've never been able to read music, really.
And so I just listened to records and, is that the chord? No, is that it? Is that it? No. There we are.
You remember whose records you were listening to while you were learning?
Well, I started off with the Kingston Trio and the Limelighters back in the early 60s, and then moved right smartly to Bob Dylan and Joni Baez. Mm-hmm. And then where did I go from there? Well, then I started listening to Lightnin' Hopkins and Mance Lipscomb and Reverend Gary Davis, old blues guys. And right about then is when I fell in with Jerry and we started playing the old country blues stuff for the jug band music.
Was Jerry a tough taskmaster? Did he call you?
Oh, hell no. He, you know, he knew about what I was good for and just was happy with that. You know, he knew how to get stuff out of me. He never really, he very, very rarely had me play anything specific. He just, you know, left me to my own devices and I tried to delight him as best I could.
It comes to us all sooner or later. Use whatever euphemism you want, you cross the river. We leave this life.
Mm-hmm.
How do you want to be remembered?
You know, really, individually for people who want to remember me, just to remember me on the moment for a song that relates to that moment for them. 'Cause that's all I'm here for.
And if you had to pick one song, just one, that you're going to be remembered for or perhaps is played at some memorial service, what would that song be? One of yours or one of somebody else's?
I Have Seen Where the Wolf Has Slept by the Silver Stream. I Can Tell by the Mark He Left You Were in His Dream. Ah, child of countless trees. Ah, child of boundless seas. What you are, what you're meant to be, speaks his name, though you were born to me, Cassidy.
Thank you very, very much.
And that's the big interview for tonight. We're always eager to hear what you have to say, so please follow us on Facebook and Twitter or send your comments to viewer@access.tv.
Driving that train, pound cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind. And know that notion just crossed my mind.
Well, that wraps up another fantastic episode of Dan Rather's The Big Interview. Now remember, if you love what you're hearing, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And of course, leave us a review and tell a friend. Thank you for joining us for Dan Rather's The Big Interview, where music and conversation come together.